Good evening again and blessings in Jesus' name. I've really enjoyed my time here. Thank you. You've been very hospitable and had some really jolly times at the table at various places. So thank you very much for that. And but you know, I am starting to get a little homesick. And that's a good sign, I think. I've really enjoyed you all, but I'm missing my church and my friends and the students there at Faith Builders. And so I guess it's time for me to go tomorrow. Anyway, I wonder, do you have any questions or observations from anything that's been said so far? Just real quick, in case you've been thinking of something. If not, we'll get right into what I'm going to talk about tonight. But any questions or observations? All right, well, let's get into, let's see. Okay. I want to talk about nurturing peaceable attitudes and practices. And I want to look at four areas: peace and the just community, peace and politics, peace and creation, peace and the resurrection. And a lot of what I've been talking about so far, and a lot of this may have a sort of an abstract sense to it, but I think that's a thing we have to do. And then from that, we need to develop what are we going to do practically. And I hope we talk a little bit about that. And I hope you bring up some observations about how we can do some of these things practically. But we are the just community, or we are supposed to be the just community. And we are supposed to be extending this out, the borders of our community, bringing others in. That's what we are called to do. I have as a verse that signifies a good bit of what I would say, anyway, that we are called to do is Micah 6:8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. And I think there are several things that it would be important for us to notice as we think about this. This is a call. It's from the Old Testament, but it's for us as well. And one of the things we need to do is distinguish between being just and demanding justice. And this might cause some people a little bit of disagreement with what I have to say. It's really popular nowadays to push for, we need to be active in pushing for social justice. And that's what I mean anyway, at least partly, by demanding justice. I would say that we need to be people who are just as we know how to be, as just as we know how to open ourselves to the God Spirit so that he helps us to do the things that are just. But it's kind of popular right now to try to think of ways to make other people be just. And that's what governments sort of do. They have their ideas, their concepts of what justice is, and they make laws, and they enforce those laws. They put that on others. And that doesn't fit what I was talking about as far as we are supposed to be a people who woo others into the kingdom. But we are supposed to be people who look to ourselves and ask God to help us see where we are not being just, ourselves personally, and how we can be just. That is something that we need to do. And to think about this just a bit, think about justice and mercy. And it's mentioned right here in this passage. We are to do justly. We are not to demand justice of others. And we're to love mercy. And that's saying that both we should recognize that we are where we are because God has shown us mercy, and then we are to show that to others. But demanding justice is a thing that brings conflict. And conflict isn't always wrong, but the better way to handle the situation, when you see someone not being just, is to do the just thing yourself, is to show what it really means to be a person that is following in the footsteps of Jesus. Doing it the other way is the political way, trying to force people to do the right thing. And that brings a certain kind of results. And sometimes it brings some good results, but it doesn't bring lasting results. And if a person changes, if a person becomes a person of justice, then we have really a change there. And thinking about it, our own selves, all of us, if I understand the scriptures correctly, deserve death. If we would have justice done to us, we would lose our lives. And that's not the way it is. The scriptures tell us that justice is overcome or is triumphed over by mercy. And that should be our approach as well. We should be a people who, first of all, establish justice and peace among ourselves. And this is, if you want to think of a verse that would point in this direction, Galatians 6:10 says this: "So, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." We should, first of all, do what we can to keep house, as they sometimes say, to figure out, to recognize, where are the people here that are hurting? Where are the situations where there's friction and you could help alleviate that friction? We should, first of all, look inside of ourselves, help each other to become peaceable, to become righteous, to really experience brotherhood. That should happen here first. If we do that, I think it will improve our witness. We should do it, first of all, though, to be obedient. We are told to do this. We should do it, next of all, to be a light in the world. And also, we should turn to others. We should turn outward. I'd say, first of all, let's clean house, first of all, and then let's turn outward. And so this working together inside the church, I would see as a legitimate kind of practice. I hope it's easier for us to forgive each other and to receive forgiveness than it may be with the person outside who needs it. So this is actually a place to practice and to experience what the joy of being a just community. Then we should turn it outward. We should become a people of hospitality. We should be people who are helpful. And I'm not saying we aren't. I'm so proud of the things we do with disaster aid. And when I first became Beachy, I experienced so much hospitality. I had no family there, but I received immense hospitality. There is a little bit of a caution here. We're very much interrelated, and family is very important, and it should be. Sometimes, depending on how you express that, somebody like me might feel a little bit excluded. Now, I didn't feel that way. I was really blessed, but I know I have others that have. So it's just a little thing to be careful about. You have something very good, but if somebody comes in from the outside, they may, depending on how you practice that and express it, that could be a little bit of a tension point. And so that's something to think about. But yes, we should look outward after we have looked inward first. And I have personally experienced some very good things along this line. Then we should, as we start to look outward, we should think very hard. How can we help? Where should we help? What can we do? And I'm calling us to be creative. The scriptures themselves don't tell us everything that we should do. And they weren't written in a day and age like we live in. And so it gives us excellent direction. But it needs to be shaped for the day. We need creative thinking about how do we now, as we turn outward, how do we help these people that are hurting? But one thing I want to encourage you really strongly is never forget little counts. You're little people, but God uses little people. And the effects of what little people do just radiate out. And so don't forget that. And the things that we do, they may seem ever so simple. You might take in a single mother, and that might not seem like a lot. But you don't know what that child may grow up to be and what he may do. This whole thing about those great men and the little people, we need both of them. Both of them move history ahead. But you aren't supposed to worry about, I'm a little person. God uses us. So take hold of that and ask yourself, what is it that really drives me? So where I live, there are some ladies who just regularly go into this center to help women, that single women that are pregnant. And so the whole point is to try to show them there's another possibility than abortion, and that we're willing to help you. Because that's one of the scary things for a young girl in this situation. What do I do? Who's going to help me? That may be a little thing, you just helping one girl, but it's helping a life or two lives, actually, and you just don't know how that's going to affect others later. There are things like, I don't know, do you do fresh air here? Do you know what that is? Do you bring children in from the city? That was one of the first things that I experienced in the Grantsville area, and it was really kind of exciting that, help children experience something different. And so they would bring children in from New York City, and many of those children gave their lives to the Lord. They hadn't heard about this before. They came to our community, and then they gave their lives to the Lord and often kept contact with the people they lived with, and sometimes even moved when they became older to the community where they had first experienced the fresh air experience. The kind of people that you're often going to be trying to help have very little structure in their lives. I think it was this morning I mentioned how I have been so blessed by my family. You've been so blessed by your families. There was structure built into your lives. One of the things that we're going to have to do as we look to be just people, not to impose it on others, but to be just people who then try to help others, is we got to recognize a lot of the people we're going to work with don't have structure in their lives. And that means leading them to the Lord isn't the last thing. It's not the only thing. They still need structure. You, when you give your life to the Lord, you've got a familial structure, you've got the church structure, and inside of you, you've been taught how to make decisions and decide what to do and go ahead and do it. And a lot of people don't have that. I worked in a jail. I worked in a halfway house in Reading, Pennsylvania, and that was the key thing that had to happen. These young men came out of prison. Usually, they had given their life to the Lord, but they didn't have the kinds of disciplines that you have. And that doesn't just happen magically because you say, I give my life to the Lord. And that is quite a struggle, helping people with in that kind of a situation. So, being a just community, it's not just focusing on ourselves. I think that we should do that first of all, that we have to recognize we need to do some work inside, and then we need to look out and see how we can help others. And as we do that, and these things happen together, so I'm not saying you do the one and then you finally do the other, but we need to do both of these things and just recognize this means a risk. One of the situations that I know of that I really admire, I've worked with fellows out of prison. I've lived with them in a halfway house. I've never really had a situation where I could ask them into my house. Melvin Lehman, who's one of our instructors, he and his wife, when they first started their family, they did this. They would have men that he got to know in his prison ministry when they came out, They would come and stay with him, and that was the whole point, was trying to build that structure into their lives. Help them learn how to hold a job steady and do things like that, that for some of them, they had no clue what to do about those things. So it is a risk, and I'm just giving you him as an example. They took a risk. They had little children. You know, he had sensible rules of the household that he expected these young men to abide by, but still, there's clearly was a risk there. But we need to be a people that are willing to risk, and that's a big one. Ask yourself, am I willing, if God calls me to do something, am I willing to take that risk? And that's part of being a just person, being willing to take that risk. The next thing I want us to think about is peace and politics, and maybe this is where we will spend more time. And when you have a time to give some observations and questions, I can imagine this might be where we would have a good number of issues coming up and questions coming up. Just before I came out here, I was reading a magazine, and there was an article by a writer named Walter E. Williams, and he was writing about government and how our founding fathers established the American government. And here's a quote from him, it just happened that I came across this, and what I want is to hear what government, how it functions. The founders recognized that we need government. However, they also recognized that the essence of government is force, and that force is evil. To reduce the potential for evil, they thought government should be as small as possible. They intended for us to have a limited republican form of government, wherein human rights proceed from government and there is rule of law. Now, what I want us to hear is, and you will usually hear this from any political scientist writer, and this person is one of those, that government is about force. Now, it's not that where it starts, but government has to have the possibility of using coercion to make sure that people follow the laws that they come up with for our own good. And so as we think about peace and politics and how do we relate to the government, and so that's what I'm thinking about with this peace and politics. One of the things to recognize is that politics requires coercion. And what we've been hearing through these three previous meetings is that that isn't how the Christian life functions. It's a life where we invite people into a different way of life. And I don't have the direct quote, but another writer, he was a German general, said that war is politics by another method. So politics needs coercion. It needs to be able to use force. We looked at two passages that I have listed here. Romans 13 and 1 Peter. I mentioned Revelation 13. And I'm not going to turn to that, but I'm just going to say a few things about it. Romans 13 and 1 Peter both tell us that government is meant for our good. But it is conducted, and it's meant to be conducted, by unredeemed men. And so there's always that potential that it could go wrong, that it could take a bad turn. In Revelation 13, we see very clearly what happens when government goes beyond what God has called it to do. When it goes beyond using the sword to restrain evil, and when it calls us to good, when it tries to elevate one person and give one person power. And so anyway, I just want us to be aware, government and politics involve coercion and often involve violence and war, and that's not what we're called to. You can turn, if you want, to 2 Corinthians. I want to look at two passages there. In 2 Corinthians 5, starting at 11, and I think I'm just going to, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to, I will read part of it, just sort of summarize it. We're told that we are supposed to persuade others. We're not supposed to force them, we're supposed to persuade them. And we're told that this whole thing that we're doing is about the love of Christ. For the love of Christ controls us, because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died. So we're supposed to, that is our focus, is bringing people to Christ, bringing them to true life. Then after that, it says that we are here, looking at verse 18, all this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. We are ambassadors, and it's the next verse. I realize I didn't go far enough. Therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ. We are ambassadors. We have a message to give. We aren't warriors, and we're reconcilers. We're people that are telling others that don't know it how they can become at peace within themselves, with others, and with God. Then, in chapter 10, Paul, I think, is still thinking about this ministry of reconciliation. And there he tells us, starting in verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. So what's that? These are things that are inside of us. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to Christ, to obey Christ. This is the warfare that we have. It's not with physical weapons. It's about us. It's about our spirit. It's about our minds. How do we think in this world? It takes us back to Romans 12, verse 2, where our minds need to be renewed. So these, all of us have these in us. We have ways of thinking that are not what they should be. And so just as I mentioned that to be a just community, we should first look inside ourselves and then look outside. To be an ambassador, to be a reconciler, we should look first inside ourselves. So where are those strongholds that haven't been taken care of? And then we can help others that have similar problems. So we destroy the strongholds within us through the power of Christ, and we help others to do that as well. And then our thoughts will be like Christ's. The next thing I would like us to consider is in Ephesians. This is a contrast to how the world does politics. How does the world affect change? Well, they try to do it through politics, which is an attempt to get more people to vote, usually in our setting anyway, to get more people to vote for us so that we can have our way in the law. And then if people don't obey those laws, we try to force them to obey those laws. That is how politics tries to improve whatever situation exists that they think are, that those particular leaders think are not very good. In Ephesians, there is, in chapter 5, there is a list of household rules, you might call it. And they are, Paul is telling Roman people who had been pagans how they should live. In Ephesians 5, he's starting about verse 18, he says, don't get drunk with wine, but But let the Spirit give you direction about how to live. And so he says, we should address one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord. We should give thanks always and for everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. So he's setting up how we ought to move ahead to help things become better. We need to be focused on what the Spirit would call us to do. We need to open our lives. We need to sing spiritual songs. We need to let the Spirit move. And we need to submit to one another. Once again, we have blind spots. We don't always see what our own problem is. And then this is the place that he launches into. So what does this mean? And for the Roman imperial days, this was extremely strange. He says, wives should submit to their husbands as to the Lord, and that husbands should... She should submit to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The mystery is profound, and I am saying that it rules... That it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respect her husband. This seems just so natural and so obvious, but this is not how people lived back then. Husbands and wives didn't relate as closely together as they should have and as they do now. And Paul was calling for a change in how they related to each other. And the husband was actually supposed to be willing to lay his life down just as Christ is willing to do that for the church. Then it talks about parents and children. The children should obey and honor their parents, and the parents should not cause the children to become... they shouldn't provoke their children. That was another thing. This is the father had complete rights. And so telling the father and the mother that they had to think about how they interacted with their children, that they actually needed to respect them, they should not provoke them, was startling, to say the least, and very revolutionary, actually. And then it tells about masters and slaves, and the part here that I think is so interesting, for the slaves it says that they are supposed to serve their master as though he were Christ, not in hypocrisy, but actually wanting to serve him. And then it says that, masters do the same to them. So the slaves have been asked to respect the masters, and the masters do the same to the slaves. This is not what they were expecting to hear. Now, this is very important because if we, I don't think I'll turn to it, but if you look at the letter of Philemon, I think we can see a contrast, a clear contrast, and a pattern that Paul wants. He's showing us here how the Christians should be separate from the rest of Roman society. They shouldn't treat their slaves or their children or their wives the way that the rest do. So Paul has told them that. In Philemon, we get a little bit deeper sense of how that should happen. In Philemon, a slave had escaped. His name was Onesimus. And he had met Paul in Rome, and Paul already knew him because Paul, or maybe Paul didn't, but at least Onesimus recognized Paul, because Onesimus's master had been converted by Paul. So when Onesimus met Paul in Rome, he interacted with him and he became a believer, and Paul sent him back to his master. And according to Roman law, that master could do anything that he wanted with him. He could say that you've taken some of my money and you stole yourself. You actually stole part, you know, by taking yourself away, you were stealing from the master. Paul doesn't say you must release your slave. Paul does give a strong indication that would be the best thing to do. And that's legitimate, I think. But Paul says, you know what you ought to do, and I have confidence you will do it. What I hear happening here is the scriptures telling us about how we ought to interact with each other in a time when these things weren't normal, they weren't natural. And then in Philemon, Paul makes it very clear, I want this to happen because you love God and you're listening to God. And so it's out of your own desire. It's not out of a command, but it's out of your own desire. And that's completely the opposite of what happens in politics or in government. And so it's really hard for me to understand how we could work in that kind of a setting. I want to tell a little bit, a few stories about some things that happened in this area that just show the kind of conflict that can so easily arise when there's a lot of tension, sometimes these things are part of what the government is doing. There were two men in this. There was one man in Kansas, and not far from here, his name was John Schrag, who was on Armistice Day, was. Everybody was out in fine spirits because the United States and the Allies had defeated Germany, and they wanted to have a parade, and they knew this man was a non-resistant man, and they tried to get him to buy war bonds. They were still selling war bonds, and they tried to get him to be at the front of a parade carrying the flag to honor had just happened. The war effort was a success. And because he didn't do this, he was almost lynched. Now, I'm not saying this was the government that did this, but this is the kind of thing that happens when people are not trying to live a non-resistant life. There were two Hutterites that were had been conscripted and gone to the military, but not put on the uniform, and eventually they were sent to Fort Leavenworth for punishment, and they were so severely treated there that they died. Now, that was the government, the effect of the government. There was an Amish bishop named Manassas Bontrager in near Dodge City, and he wrote a letter in the budget that, you all know what the budget is, right? He wrote a letter in the budget that encouraged young Amishmen and the Amish communities to stand fast. We shouldn't be buying war bonds. I don't remember everything that he wrote. At this time, there were two laws on the books that had just been passed. One was the Espionage Act in 1917. That's against spying. And then there was a Sedition Act. That's against undermining the government and its actions. That was passed in 1918. And he and the editor of the budget were taken to court by the government and threatened with prison. They said they will not say any more along the lines of encouraging people not to obey the government as it was promoting its war effort. They, however, were fined $500 and court costs, and I guess that was it for them. There was a man in Virginia, actually two men in Virginia, who were doing something like this. The one man was a bishop, and the other man was a home missionary. And he asked his bishop, "What should I say about the war effort?" And his bishop said, "Tell people not to cooperate." And there was a letter that he had written to the man that asked the question. Somehow the government got a hold of that letter, and they took these two men to court as well for the same for going against the same law, and they were both fined $1,000. Remember, this is 1918. That was a lot of money. The Virginia Conference did pay that for them. But anyway, I'm just showing you some things that actually affected some of your people in this state, and the inconsistency or the impossibility of really working with that if a person is, with that kind of approach, if a person is a Christian. Now, but that doesn't tell us what we ought to do. I think I want to tell you a story from my life that would help you understand why I feel this is so harmful. When I was still Catholic, the Roe v. Wade was passed, decided by the Supreme Court, and that allowed abortions all throughout the United States. And that was something that Catholics were very much against, and I was at the right age, and I was really politically interested. And so from the very beginning, I was involved in being against Roe v. Wade. I voted, and I even voted, I think, twice after I became Beachy. I am not proud of this. I also did some marching. I'm not proud of this, and I'll tell you why. It felt right, and it felt good, because here's something that is demonstrably wrong. But that doesn't mean the approach I had was not also demonstrably wrong. I was trying to use the state to force people to live like Christians. And the first thing that I saw happen was this. When Roe v. Wade started, and like I said, I was involved right at the beginning, the people who were in favor of that decision were not at ease with the talking about, "Aren't you killing a life?" They were very uneasy about that. However, the more it went on and the more it became a political football, so to speak, and the more that people like myself, the moral majority, got out there and tried to elect presidents and congressmen and senators to change that ruling, the angrier people got, because what they were hearing was me telling them, people on this side especially, how you're supposed to use your own body. And that doesn't go. In the United States, that would be trying to do away with somebody's civil rights. And so the argument and the force of it shifted from, at first, a really uneasy feeling about, yeah, we think we have to help women this way, and it makes us feel bad, but this is, you know, this is a life here. So there was a lot of dis-ease there, but that shifted. The more political we became and the more we pushed for laws to be changed, the anger mounted, because who are you to tell me how to handle my body? Remember, this would have been seen as a Christian practice, and we're trying to force non-Christians to practice or live their lives like a Christian. But the second thing I saw was this. As time went on, the issue about whether this is a child or not sort of disappeared, or at least it left the political discussion a little bit. And it became, the thing that started to happen was, I saw this and I heard people, they started, the people who are on the other side started to have, it was like there was a wall between them, and not me specifically, although that might be part of it, but there was a wall between them because of things I was doing and Christ. So when they heard somebody's a Christian, they turned them off. When they heard the gospel, they turned it off. That was that oppressive thing that's trying to tell me how to live my life. Now, I'm not saying that what we were trying to get done was wrong in and of itself, but the way we were doing it was wrong. And we were trying to control other people, and that doesn't go over very well. Let's see, is there anything else there? No, I think I'll stop there. And I want to talk about peace and creation and peace and the resurrection. And actually that Romans 8 fits with both of these. I think I'll be end up going past 8. So why don't I hope this is okay. I can't remember now who's doing the singing. Okay, would you lead another song? Do you have a song?
Sure.
Okay, did you have something then?
No, I was just going to say I gave you permission to go later than you're going to.
Yeah, I do think that's why I'm giving time for the song, and so I think we'll go past a good bit past 8. So, okay, a song.